and welcome to Session 509, Beyond Resettlement, Overcoming Hurdles to Document the Experiences and Contributions of Refugees. Refugees are an underrepresented and underdocumented group in archival collections. Refugee collections are essential to expanding our perceptions of history, culture, memory, and modern society. The goal of this session is that the participants as archivists will share their experiences in reaching out to refugee groups to become donors and their approaches in overcoming real and imagined hurdles or barriers to establishing archival relations with refugee groups. I'm very happy to have a panel that is very distinguished and very accomplished, and so I'm thrilled to have them here today. And I especially want you to give a warm welcome to Paul Dunman, because he came all the way from London to be here and present. He went to a lot of effort, not only to come here, but to get a bursary from the government for funding. So we have Paul Dunman, and he has been responsible for the Refugee Archive at the University of East London Docklands campus since November 2002, and he also has been in charge of the Olympics Archives and Library, so he's been quite busy lately. He has 10 years of experience working within the UK higher education sector and has professional qualifications in both librarianship and archives administration. He is a chartered member of CILIP, the Chartered Institute of Library Information Professionals. He is a member of the Society of Archivists, the International Council of on Archives, the British Records Association, and the UK branch of Archivists Without Borders. Paul is currently completing a postgraduate degree in archives administration, and his chosen dissertation topic is Minority Groups, Minority Archives, Are Refugee Communities Adequately Recorded in the Archives of East London, a Case Study. And then to my right, we have Christina Wu. She is from the University of California, Irvine. She is the research librarian for the Southeast Asian Archive at UC Irvine. She succeeded the founding librarian, Anne Frank, in 2007. She earned her master's in librarianship from UC Berkeley and has spoken at conferences on Asian American studies, research, and about the Southeast Asia Archive. She is also the research librarian for Chicano Latino Studies, Linguistics, Music, and Dance. And next we have Thuy Vo Deng. Did I pronounce that right? Okay. And she is a postdoctorate fellow at the Department of Asian American Studies at UC Irvine. She earned her PhD in Ethnic Studies from the University of California here in San Diego in 2008. She was also a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute of American Cultures Asian American Studies Center at UCLA from 2009 to 2010, and a visiting scholar from 2010 to 2011. For her doctoral dissertation on cultural politics and memory, Thuy conducted oral histories with first-generation Vietnamese Americans in San Diego. She is the lead research project director for the Vietnamese American Oral History Project at UC Irvine Southeast Asia Archive. And I'm Ann Mallett. I'm at the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech Universities. I'm the archive's first Vietnamese American Heritage Archivist, and I became that position in 2008, and I joined the archive in 2007. And from my work with the FVPPA and VAHF, I received an award from the Vietnamese American Heritage Foundation. So I hope you'll enjoy our session, and we'll start with Paul. And let me pull up his presentation.
Right, okay then. Yeah, thank you. So my name is Paul Dunman, and I'm the archivist responsible for the Refugee Council Archive at the University of East London. Apologies if I do sound sort of slightly nervous, as I sort of do have a slight stammer, but I'm hoping that's not going to be too much of a problem. Okay, the scope of this presentation will be twofold. The first half of the presentation will aim to look at the work that we've been undertaking will be to consider the work that we are undertaking at the Refugee Council Archive at the University of East London. Okay. And we'll look at this as a sort of case study example to consider the hurdles and approaches to overcoming the sort of relevant barriers in trying to manage and develop an archive which is dedicated to the refugee. The second half of this paper will also be to briefly consider the wider work being undertaken in the UK in general to consider what's been undertaken to collect and preserve archives in relation to the refugee experience. Okay, so why collect refugee archives? It is important to collect archives in relation to the refugee, in relation to the refugee experience, as refugees have been traditionally sort of underdocumented in the and underrepresented in the sort of archive. Start again. Refugees have traditionally been sort of. I've lost my place now. Refugees have been traditionally sort of underdocumented and underrepresented in sort of the sort of UK archival collections. The records of refugees are therefore essential for expanding our own perceptions of history, culture, and memory. As argued by Philip Marfleet in a recent article entitled Refugees and History, Why We Must Address the Past, engagement with history is not straightforward. However, it is important to ask why have histories ignored most refugee movements and silenced those involved. Can refugees be reinstalled within the historical record? How did the archive of the Refugee Council come to be located at the University of East London? The Refugee Council archive was deposited at the University of East London in November 2002. This was in response to a campaign by several members of academic staff who were working in the then School of Social Sciences, who were running a sort of fairly successful postgraduate master's level course in refugee studies. The sort of Refugee Council archive collection at that time was located in a sort of an old basement at the sort of Refugee Council archive offices, and it lay sort of unused and undeveloped for about 4 or 5 years. So the academics were keen to sort of bring the archive to the university in order to help with the running and sort of development of the postgraduate MA course. In addition to the Refugee Council archive now, we do hold several other smaller collections of refugee-related materials. These now include the archive of the Council for Assisting Refugee Academics and a small archive in relation to the Northern Refugee Centre, and an audiovisual collection of the London Office of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. In addition to our sort of predominantly refugee-orientated collections, UEL does hold several other collections, which currently include the archive and library of the appropriate sort of British Olympic Association, and also a smaller collection relating to the sort of Hackney Empire Theatre. Okay, so just to give you a brief bit of background on the actual Refugee Council itself, the The organisation was founded in 1951 as the British Council for Aid to Refugees and the Standing Conference on Refugees. These two organisations subsequently merged in 1981 to form the British Refugee Council. This organisation is now the largest charity within the UK, specifically dealing with the sort of social welfare issues in relation to refugees and asylum seekers. What does the Refugee Council Archive at UEL offer? The archive itself consists of a range of thematic materials dating back from the early 1950s onwards. The archive includes essentially the archive collection is twofold. It includes both the sort of the more traditional archival collections of the British Refugee Council as an organisation, and also a thematic sort of special collection of sort of associated materials which deal more which has been sort of collected by the Refugee Council Archive, the Refugee Council, in the course of their work. This special collection of material was the first part of the archive to be transferred over to us. It essentially contains semi-published materials relating to all aspects of the Refugee Council. The Council's work with refugees and asylum seekers. When this collection was originally transferred, it was estimated to contain around approximately 25,000 individual items, which included a broad range of materials, including published books and journals, reports and sort of grey literature incorporating working papers, conferences, leaflets, newsletters, case studies, field reports, statistical data, and press cuttings. Originally, the actual organisational part of the archive was retained by the sort of Refugee Council as it related to their sort of ongoing work. However, in the last few weeks, they have recently sort of transferred over to us approximately 40 boxes of sort of new material, which deal directly with the sort of the operational work of the Refugee Council itself. So, these still have to be sorted and catalogued, but essentially, these will include sort of meetings of the organisation and correspondence and the more sort of traditional types of archival material dating back to the early 1950s. Okay, what are the barriers? What are the barriers in terms of sort of the archive trying to work with sort of refugee community groups within the UK? One of the major problems we do face within the archive is a sort of general sort of lack of resources. These include, for example, these include a range of issues, including limited staffing. Basically, we only now have one member of staff for the whole archival collection. So it's inevitably has a knock-on effect onto the range of services that we are able to offer, and the amount of sort of or lack of outreach work that we are able to do. Yeah. As a sort of knock-on effect to this, we do have it's probably fair to say we do have sort of fairly inconvenient opening hours, as a which we've been sort of required to sort of tailor to meet to meet the needs of our internal staff and students, essentially, as they are the sort of the largest sort of user group for the collection. There are also ongoing issues in regard to the actual funding of the archive. Added to this, as I sort of touched upon earlier, there are also sort of significant archival backlogs in terms of cataloguing new materials for the collection. Essentially, the Refugee Council archive has both a national and an international focus. So we sort of try to collect archival materials on all aspects of the refugee experience, but both specifically in relation to the UK and internationally, generally. This, in a way, sort of ties into the support work we do for our postgraduate students, who the university tries to attract a broad range of students with a range of refugee backgrounds and experience onto the course. So we do try and cater as far as we can for their information needs in relation to the archive. We also have a further barrier has been the lack of an externally focused website. We do have a university-based website for the collection, but this is fairly static and primarily focused towards our internal staff and students. So it's not really conducive to acting as an outreach tool for refugee community groups. I think it's also briefly worth considering the idea of the refugees' own perceptions in relation to their own identity. My work with the Refugee Archive has raised consideration of the question of how refugee communities are represented within the archival record, and the impact that this may have on the theories surrounding the formation of identity, which can be very problematic given the transitory nature of the refugee experience. This raises questions in regard to refugee experiences and their perceptions of belonging and otherness, and whether those who are defined as refugees would strongly identify as being a refugee, as opposed to say as a member of an ethnic minority, or as a member of a political, religious, cultural, or political community. This also raises questions of how refugees are represented in the actual surviving records, and whether this is close to how refugees would define themselves, and whether there are disparities between oral and written records. What can possibly be done to improve this situation? There are several aspects I'm conscious that I need to work on in order to try and This will make the collection more accessible to refugee community groups. One of these aspects that may be seen in terms of retrospective cataloguing. Before leaving for pastures new, a colleague of ours in the archive recently completed a number of archival descriptions, which are now hosted on two external websites, namely the Archives Hub and AIM25. Both of these websites provide comprehensive and searchable access to a large and growing number of archival descriptions, thus making them more accessible to a growing number of researchers and interested parties. We do have a limited description of the refugee collections on this site, but certainly this is one area that could be improved. I've also been conscious of the fact that we do probably need to overhaul our current online provision in relation to the archive, and perhaps to make better use of the social media options which are now available. I'm also conscious of the fact that we do need to have greater involvement with the community archiving sector, and equally with ongoing campaigns within the archival sector more generally. Anyway, I'm conscious of the fact I'm probably running fairly short on time. Yeah. Okay, so what I was going to do in the second half of the paper, which I'm probably not going to have time to cover now, is to very briefly look at the work that has been done in the UK more generally, as in the last few years there has been a growing movement towards trying to make collections of refugee and ethnic minority communities more accessible and available to the public more generally. This has included work done by the National Archives and equally the London Metropolitan Archives based in London. There has also been a growing use of community archiving with a particular emphasis on refugee and ethnic minority communities. Anyway, I'll stop there, but I do have copies of the entire presentation and further information on the table here if you would be interested. I'll stop there. Okay.
Good morning. Thank you so much for coming and joining us on the last day of the conference. My name is Christina Wu, and I'm the research librarian for the Southeast Asian Archive at the University of California, Irvine Libraries, as Anne introduced me. And this was established at UCI in 1987 in response to the urging of a member of the Vietnamese American community. Since 1987, it has been a magnet for researchers, scholars, and investigators from all parts of the U.S., and in addition, students and faculty and other researchers from Canada and Asia have traveled to Southern California to use the collections. So it is a premier collection, and one of the things that we are realizing in the Southeast Asian Archive is that the community whose mission we have to document their experiences as refugees and immigrants leaving their home countries is something that the community doesn't know that much about what an archive is and why it's not only important to us but important to them as well. So community members and organizations have donated materials to enrich the collections, and these focus on the diaspora from Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. Not counting the UCI students who use the archive for their research, however, very few community members venture to the campus to visit the archive. And many of the barriers are obvious to us. And it was sort of both heartwarming and sad to see that some of the same problems are over in the UK. Our hours are relatively inconvenient. Basically, Monday through Friday, 1 to 5, no evening, no weekends, when the community might be more have more time to come and visit. Parking on campus is $2 to $4 an hour or $10 for the day. For $10, they could go see a movie and get free parking. So we're not very much of a deal there. Much of the collection does not circulate, like most archives, and but for a lot of our collection, we allow flash photography without flash. In addition, and I'll be taking you on a little tour of the archive, a photo tour, the collections are not that easy to find. The collections are in two locations, a reading room that's open access on the third floor in the back corner. It's a very nice room, but it's the back corner of on the third floor of a six-story building. And then the archival collections, we have 39 of them, about 400 linear feet, but that also counts the vertical file, which is in the reading room. The archival collections are, of course, in closed stacks on the fifth floor on the other side of the building. So to move back and forth takes a little bit of walking. Some of the barriers that we suspect, but we're not so sure about, is that community members whose first language is not English may not feel comfortable coming to an archive and asking very many questions in their own language. So maybe bringing a friend or a relative who speaks more English might be something that they feel necessary to do. Those with no connection to our campus or any university or college campus may not know how wide open our doors are. So they may think, aren't college campuses just for college people? You know, I'm not a student, I'm not an alum, I'm not a staff member, so why would I go to this campus? And some community members may have very little library experience, and what is an archive anyway? So these are some of the questions that we think may be in people's minds. And so we really need to redouble our efforts to make our collections something that they want to come to see. We could not change the obvious barriers much, but we could take the Southeast Asian Archive to the community. And we've done this via, we call it sometimes a road show or a trunk show. And I've brought some of it here. The posters are there. They're trifold, so they fold in to themselves. They're fairly portable. And I'm going to, show you some of the text. And as you can see, the text is across the top and the images are across the bottom. So let me show some of these to you now. We wrote this in the amount of text that we felt could describe it, but not a whole lot of information. And definitely, this is text for the general public, not for other archivists, researchers, and not even necessarily for people who have a bachelor's degree. We wanted this to be very friendly for the community. We also wanted this to be very friendly in terms of a lot of images of materials from our collection. We have a circulating and a non-circulating collection, but in either case, we did not want to bring circulating materials from our collection to the general public when we go into the community to events, to holiday festivals, gatherings, picnics in the park, that sort of thing. And also, we wanted to make sure that we didn't take materials that we would care if they had food on them or people handled them with children, and especially things that we might care if they disappeared. So what we've done is we've gathered materials that are duplicates from our collection and that we have made duplicates of. So in our circulating collection for books, for example, if we happen to buy a copy of something and then we got a second copy as a gift, second copy goes into our roadshow, and that's what we take out into the community. We also wanted our photos in the posters to show people using our collections and what does it look like to use an archive. The term archive was for somebody like me who's been a librarian since 1975. I did not come into librarianship through the archival or the archivist route in terms of the courses I took and that sort of thing. So for somebody who's been an academic librarian as long as I have, working with archives is not something that I knew a great deal about myself. In addition, when we go to into the community, when an internet connection is available, I take a laptop and I show off the web page for the archive. And I encourage you to give us a whirl. We would have loved to have done that today, but as you know, in these rooms we don't have an internet connection. So there we are, seaa.lib.uci.edu. And we also have full-color brochures in Vietnamese, Lao, Hmong, Khmer, and in English. Yes, thank you. So when we take materials to the community, we take some of the things that we have in our circulating collection, and many of these are in Vietnamese, Hmong, Lao, or Khmer, but many of them are in English. Some of these are things that we make sure we keep in our collection, but we have a circulating copy in the collection, but this is one that we don't have to check out. It's not checked out in anybody's name. Okay. Then, and so I have postal bins of these that I take. And then, because we assume people might not know what this actually looks like and feels like, even though we have images of them in the photos. I'm going to step over here. So we've made a pretend box. It's duplicates, and we let people know we have photos, and we would welcome their photos from their own files, community, family events, etc. These are, of course, color photocopies, but they look like photos. And, pardon me, and then we have files that we try to, thank you, that we, you know, we make it look like a real file, and we've made photocopies of government reports and refugee things and resettlement things. And some of these are copy twos as well. So they go in here, and they can see how they're labeled and how various, how they can make their way through these collections. We've selected things from some of our most frequently used collections so they can see what other researchers have used and what community members have become excited about. When we put these materials out on the tables and just let people explore them themselves, and they talk among themselves and they pick something up and they show them to other people, many of them are speaking in a language that I don't speak, but it's really fascinating to see their excitement in many cases. There are parent-child interactions that we get to see, and there are parents who maybe are seeing some materials that they haven't seen in a really, really long time, refugee and orientation materials. We have these little tent cards that say across the top, duplicates from the UCI Library's Southeast Asian Archive. So they know that these are duplicate materials. This one says, refugees seek asylum. Another one says, resettlement experiences. Yet another one says, scholarship about Southeast Asian refugees and immigrants. So we can group things for people who want to go to one area or another. And generally, two long tables at minimum works real well for us. These posters sit on a table without any easel, and they just they transport, fairly easily. So let me take you on a little photographic tour now. So this is just a quick tour as if you were walking through into the libraries for the first time, and how do you get to the Southeast Asian Archive, and when you get there, what does it look like? So we're in Jack Langston Library at UC Irvine, up in Orange County, and it's a six-story building, up the steps, into the lobby, and on the third floor. The lobby is the second floor, so it's just one flight up. Here are our limited hours. And they'll come in and they'll see a room initially full of books. And we have posters from community events and some paintings from refugee camps on the wall. They're all reproductions, of course, of the paintings. All of these books circulate, and so people who don't even have a library card can request them via interlibrary loan at their local public library. I've pulled a bunch of materials on the table for a visit by our advisory board. And this is a one of 60 file folder drawers. I think it says communities Hmong American to communities Lahu American. And that's what it looks like to work in a drawer. This is now something from the closed stack. So our community would not be allowed to see this, but we want them to see what the closed stacks look like. And then this box, of course, lets them handle one of the boxes. So it's row after row after row. And then these are some images from materials in our collection, photographs, reports, etc. These we have sort of in a gallery type setting on the walls in the Southeast Asian Archive reading room on the third floor. This is from a map to get to the fifth floor. And this is one of our archivists preparing or processing a collection. So these are paintings from our collection that are on the fifth floor in flat files that is very, very popular for researchers, immediately before those were photographs in our collection. More paintings. Photograph. Photograph. This is a painting. Photograph. A handwritten letter and photograph. And finally, this is a photograph of our advisory board after their visit to our stacks. We took them into the closed stacks. Our current collecting focus is on archival collections, so building trust in the community so they would be willing to part with their materials and entrust them to us is super critical, as the first wave of immigrants and refugees is becoming older, they're passing away, their families may be disposing of their papers and their materials, not realizing of their value for us and for researchers, and to preserve the history of the community. So we're making a greater effort to reach out into the community and to let them know that, one, this archive exists, that we can keep these materials forever in temperature and humidity-controlled environment, and that they can come and visit them in our safekeeping. So this is our challenge. And I finally want to give credit for this whole roadshow to Michelle Light, who is the head of Special Collections and Archives at the University of California, Irvine. And this grew out of a couple of conversations we had when we said, oh, we should represent the archive at such and such fair or such and such event where there would be people from off campus there. But then we would both say, but we can't take things from our collection. You know, sort of, we were prisoners of the fact that our collections had to stay in one place. So this was our way of bringing it out to the community and letting them touch and see it. And hopefully by us providing materials for them to take away with them, our brochures, having them see our website, they would want to come to the collection, or at least consider us when it was time to get rid of some of those old papers in the closet in the back of the garage. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Okay, so my name is Thuy Vo Dang, and I'm actually kind of the black sheep on the panel because I am not an archivist or librarian. I got my training in ethnic studies, and I'm a postdoctoral fellow directing the Vietnamese American Oral History Project, which has led me to work very closely with Christina Wu, Michelle Light, who's head of our special collections at UC Irvine. So my presentation is actually coming after Christina. It makes a whole lot of sense. So I'm glad she was able to go first. Today I'm going to talk about specifically outreach to the Vietnamese American community through the Oral History Project and how that's simultaneously raising awareness about the Southeast Asian Archive and the importance of archives in general. So I'm going to just go through it really quickly because I want to make sure we do have some time at the end for some Q&A. I'll give you some demographic information about the Vietnamese American community. We'll talk about some of its unique characteristics. And then I will talk about oral history case studies to give you a sense of some of the stories that we've been collecting in the course of this past academic year. So I'm somewhat new. I've only been doing this for about a year, doing oral history in the community. But previous to that, my dissertation research was here in San Diego, where I did many interviews with first-generation elders that I worked with over a five-year period in a nonprofit organization. So I'm very familiar with some of the ways in which nonprofits do work, and especially the ways in which Vietnamese elders do work in the community. So the question that has been driving me and driving me for all these years is, how do those whose histories have been erased or distorted craft their own identities, communities, and archives? And I added the archives, actually, just this past year. So as you may all know, Vietnam is acknowledged internationally by the flag on your left, the red flag with the yellow star after 1975. South Vietnam, which is, you know, no longer in existence, is represented by this now defunct flag. But this flag, the yellow flag with three red stripes, is called the Freedom and Heritage flag, and still the only flag that's recognized by the refugee community in the United States. So these are very contentious symbols for the community. The two competing discourses that I'm referring to are the national histories that have been written about Vietnam and its people. So national history in Vietnam post-1975 privileges this narrative about one united nation that has repeatedly overcome colonizing forces such as Chinese, French, you know, later Americans get grouped into that category. So the narrative that gets written overall is about, you know, essentially in its construction, obliterates refugee history or writes refugees as traitors to the nation, right? In the United States, the national history is very much focused on 58,000 Americans who lost their lives in Vietnam. It's very much about an era where Americans lost their innocence. So certainly it's a very U.S.-centered perspective that when refugees are mentioned at all is usually about how refugees serve as the way in which the U.S. redeems itself as a humanitarian nation, right? So we won the war by saving the refugees, even though we technically lost the war. Does that make sense? So these are two very different national memories. So where would refugee or exile history fall within these national landscapes? And the community, Vietnamese Americans in particular, are very prolific in their writing, in their publications, but their self-publications about their stories. And these oftentimes just circulate within the community. But fortunately, we have the Southeast Asian Archive that's been able to really gather many of these, you know, Vietnamese language sources to hopefully serve a resource for scholars and others who are interested in multiple perspectives on the Vietnam War and, you know, after-war consequences. The two narrators that I worked with in the past told me, and these are two separate individuals, they said some things that gave me a lot of food for thought in my research thereafter. One person said, you know, right now I'm still upset because we do not have a lot of books, you know, writing good things about the South Side. He means South Vietnam or the Republic of Vietnam. So the second informant or narrator told me, we're not like other Americans or even Asians. We have a unique history. It shows because we have this difficult relationship with our motherland. And these were comments that were made to me in Vietnamese that I translated. So I still hope that I get kind of the tenor of their argument accurate. But both of these sentiments really express, you know, the need to capture their narratives, their stories, and that to have this perspective would allow for them to construct identity, construct community, and have a voice, you know, in various spheres of American life, whether it be politics, culture, what have you. So just I'm going to plow through this part real quickly. The Vietnamese in the U.S., according to the 2010 census, let's see. We have a total population of over 1.5 million, and that's a 38% increase in the last 10 years, the last 12 years. or 10 years according to this data. The state with the largest concentration of Vietnamese Americans is, of course, California. Here in Southern California, Orange County is sort of considered the cultural capital of the overseas Vietnamese community. And that includes communities that have relocated to France, Australia, Canada. So this kind of gives you a nice breakdown of where you can find the 25%. Oh, you can't see that very well. But the 38% is in California. 25% is this? My colors got messed up. That's why I'm like, this looks really odd. Okay, so we're going to forget about this slide for now and talk about Vietnamese American communities and their unique characteristics. So the history of the Vietnamese American community community's formation in Little Saigon or Orange County is really because of, you know, one key factor, of course, is Camp Pendleton, which is located just a little bit north of here, a little bit south of Orange County. And so the four resettlement centers that were set up in 1975 to receive the first wave that left Vietnam essentially tried to disperse these refugees all over the country, right? So they wouldn't create an economic impact in any one region. But, you know, refugees sort of made their own minds to recongregate and reunite and build a strong cultural capital in Orange County through these secondary migrations. And to share a personal story, this is exactly what happened to my own family. We came in 1984 via the refugee camps. We were boat people. And we were sponsored. We have a huge family, 9 children, 2 parents. So we wanted to stay intact, so we had to wait for a large sponsor. So a congregation in upstate New York, Jamestown, where Lucille Ball makes home, they sponsored us in 84 to Buffalo, New York. And then it was about, I think, June or July in the summer, so it wasn't too bad yet. But I think we made it to November, and my parents decided, that's it, we're heading west. They boarded us, you know, onto a bus, a Greyhound, and we traveled out to Orange County. So our family's history actually reflects the trends in the dispersal and then the secondary migrations of Vietnamese refugees, eventually forming what, you know, we often refer to as these ethnic enclaves that provide a sense of institutional completeness. So last night over dinner, we were talking about how Vietnamese are the API group that has the highest level of linguistic isolation. And in part, it's because of, you know, how Little Saigon has really thrived to provide every, to really serve every aspect of life, right? From, you can go to the doctor and get your hair cut and grocery shop and all in Vietnamese language here in this area. Okay. So, my role at UCI has been to build an oral history collection of Vietnamese American stories in Southern California. And one of the things that I've learned, and I have brochures with me here today, so I hope you'll take some. But one of the things that I've learned in trying to figure out ways in which I can outreach to the community and connect them to the archive and make them feel a sense of ownership of the archive is that we need to use different keywords, right? So in my presentations to different audiences, from community audiences to academic audiences, to even high school audiences that I've talked to, I try to emphasize 3 main factors of the Oral History Project, which is that it is essentially about community, education, and preservation. And then I break all of these down to them in terms of my own role is to be this bridge, right, between the students on campus. I filter them out into the community through helping them find internships with nonprofits in the community. I send them out to interview folks in the community, their parents, or other people. And that's, you know, the link with the course that I teach at UCI. Preservation is a really difficult idea to explain to the community. And this is where, you know, Christina has already talked about how, archives is a difficult word to translate literally. As I was talking about archives on the Vietnamese language radio show that I do weekly, you know, we kind of debated back and forth, my co-host and I, whose Vietnamese is exceptional and mine is, you know, passable. I said, how do I say archive? I kept using the word in Vietnamese, kho, which means storage, right? And so I'm thinking of the you store it. And it's just not the same thing. And he said, no, that just doesn't get at the meaning of archive. So he gave me another term, Kovang, right? Which is a very elitist, like, sort of intellectual term that the average radio listener wouldn't be able to relate to. So I struggled with that. Which term would I use to describe the archive that I'm representing at UCI? Do I use storage, or do I use this kind of more elite term that actually translates as archive? So we still go back and forth about that, but that has really taught me a valuable lesson about using keywords, using words, using, you know, the kinds of approaches to community. So some of the things that I've now learned not to do is throw out terms like research, scholarship, preservation, archives even, and in favor of terms such as heritage, future generations, family history, voice, these are advocacy terms that nonprofits already use. And so I'm learning that we can integrate that certainly when we represent the archive, or we represent what we do as academics in the community. So lastly, because I think I'm short on time now, the oral history project that I do, the Vietnamese American Oral History Project, VAOHP, you can find it. I'll have information in the next page. But our website through UCI Libraries is now public and viewable. So if you go there and look for us, you can read through the first batch of oral histories that my students did in the winter, this past winter, 2012. They collected about 36 oral histories. 29 of them are up. They are fully processed. They've been transcribed. Some of them have been translated to English as well. There are photos and documents that are attached to each narrator's stories. So please check those out. For the students who have done these oral histories, they come back and present their findings, you know, to their classmates. And I've taken a lot of these students out into community spaces to present as well at open mic nights. We just did a summer social mixer at a senior apartment in Garden Grove, where there's a very high concentration of Vietnamese Americans. And a group of my 7 students and I went in there, and in Vietnamese and in English, the population of Vietnamese American residents in there was something like 75%. And then the rest are Korean American, Latino, other. So we were doing this program where basically we're providing food and mixing with seniors so that we can build the trust and rapport in order to eventually come in and interview some of these folks. And so, of course, food helped. And the fact that students, whether they were able to speak Vietnamese or not, still really tried to connect with the elders. And I partner with nonprofits wherever I can. So this particular program with the Grove Senior Apartments, I partnered with an organization called Engage. Imagine Engage with the age capitalized. So that's how their program is essentially going into these senior apartments and doing activities like Senior Olympics, crafts activities to promote active aging for seniors. And so when I went on the radio, a senior gentleman contacted me when he heard the project, and he said, "You should come to our apartment. We have activities. You should do an activity here." And so flash forward a few months later, I encouraged my students to write for a grant at UCI. They got it, and now we're programming in the senior apartments. So in this process, we're really talking about, we're hitting on all of those keywords that I just mentioned, talking about how the time is now, it's urgent for you to leave your story behind. What legacy do you want your children and your families to have when you're gone? And the archive, the Southeast Asian Archive in particular, can help you do that. We're a service provider in a sense, right? So this is really helping them to see, okay, this space is not, you know, elitist, because there is fundamentally this contradiction in the way in which refugees think. And I'm going to address what Paul said very quickly about the refugees' own perceptions, right? For in my work with the community, I found that there's a simultaneous distrust of institutions, but it exists with this deep respect for hierarchy and education. Right, so these two things seem to, you know, to somewhat contradict each other, but they make a whole lot of sense if you understand the history of what they've been through with war and displacement and the whole processing of refugees in the 80s. So, this is a really important contradiction to understand, so that we can start tailoring our approach to community outreach, so that we start to use the keywords that community can engage with, so that we can understand the spaces where they would feel comfortable. So in October, when I'm having essentially a ta-da opening of the Vietnamese American Oral History Project for the community, we're doing it in Little Saigon, not UCI. We're going to bring UCI personnel to the community. We're going to show off the website, and we're going to set up portable laptop stations where they can peruse. We'll have volunteers show them how to peruse the website as well. So, you know, using, you know, my experience working in the community and always straddling the university and the community all these years, I'm really trying to implement ways to make the archive a really kind of community-friendly space. So this is where you can find us. If we had a website, I would click on that first link and show you the library. But you can find us via OHP. And all of these other sites are, the social media sites are really helping us to get the word out to people we need. And the third site is actually our blog site, where you can read about the project's developments, what students are doing, what I've been up to, and my email contact. Thank you.
Okay. Hello, my name is Anna Mallett. The title of my presentation is Saving the Voices of Olac. That is the old name for Vietnam. The Vietnam Center and Archive was created in 1989 by Dr. James Reckner and other Vietnam veterans, who, with the mission of documenting the Vietnam War from all perspectives. In 2008, the Vietnam Archive created its Vietnamese American Heritage Project to fill in the missing piece of its collections, the voices of Vietnamese Americans. Vietnamese Americans have a very unique immigration experience. Over half of all overseas Vietnamese reside in the United States, and Vietnamese Americans are the fourth largest Asian group in the United States, and 72% are naturalized citizens. There's many programs that they came through to the United States, but the one I'm going to be dealing with today is the Orderly Departure Program, which was created by the United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees. This program, Orderly Departure, is the first and only time the UNHCR has assisted refugees from leaving their home of origin. And by its closure, it was founded in 79, by its closure in 94, it had helped 500,000 Vietnamese get out of Vietnam. The reason why they created it was because of the high death toll of Vietnamese boat people. From 1978 through the mid-80s, we don't know the exact numbers, but estimated from 1 to 2 million Vietnamese fled Vietnam. It was highly dangerous and it was illegal. And so they created this program to help them leave in a more systematic and safe manner. I don't have the numbers for the ODP reopening in 2005 and reclosing, but I'm going to be telling you about our Vietnamese American Heritage Project at Vietnam Archive and a little bit about it, and then also some of the hurdles we overcome with it. This is the poster that everything I'm showing you I've worked with our IT person to create. This is our poster, and it's also here at the bottom on the table. But I chose the words at the top because of some of the issues that my co-panelists have mentioned. What will future generations be told about the Vietnamese diaspora? And who will be telling the story? It is your story. Let your voice be heard. And then we have a trifolded brochure. And I have some here. I would love for you to take some home with you. And this is, it's trifolded. This is the front, and it basically tells a little bit about our project. And then on the back, it tells about oral history and how to participate in our oral history program. Along with our VAHP, I created the Vietnamese American Subject Guide so that our researchers could understand a little bit about the Vietnamese American immigration experience, and it would give them keyword searches to use for our virtual archive, and it selects collections and books that they would be interested in, and it also refers them to other Vietnamese organizations that might help them if I can't. The cornerstone of our VAHP is the Families of Vietnamese Political Prisoners Association. We consider this the Ellis Island for Vietnamese Americans, and it was donated to us by the Vietnamese American Heritage Foundation. And this is the website where you can access the Finding Aid. There's a name search database where you can search the Orderly Departure Program, because the FVPA helped over 10,000 former Vietnamese political prisoners, along with their families, immigrate out of Vietnam through ODP, particularly mostly to the United States, but also other free countries. And we held the opening ceremony, and you can read the speeches and the letters of support that we got. And the ODP name search database has become a great search tool. To explain the ODP and FVPPA, I have a 2-minute news clip by Peter Jennings, ABC World News Tonight, September 11th, 1984, called Vietnamese Refugees. Oops, I didn't. We'll do this way. I'm sorry. Give it a second.
In Washington today, the Reagan administration has been telling Congress it wants to do more for those Vietnamese who were left behind. That's a reference to thousands of Vietnamese who were loyal to the American cause in Vietnam and who subsequently have paid dearly for their allegiance. Here's ABC's Dennis Trout in Washington.
In the desperate panic of the 1975 evacuation from Vietnam, thousands were left behind who should not have been. Thousands with ties to the Saigon government or to the U.S. Embassy. Since then, more than 1 million people have fled. The U.S. has taken in these refugees at a rate of 50,000 a year. Some left relatives behind.
I came here by myself. Every time I'm thinking about my husband and all my friends, they said no hope. And we think we never see them again.
Secretary of State George Shultz today asked Congress to support a new effort to arrange the release of its former allies and employees.
These current and former political prisoners are a particular humanitarian concern to the United States.
The U.S. is responding to two recent offers from Hanoi, the latest in May, to free its political prisoners if the U.S. will take them in.
What they need really is some sort of good publicity for their regime.
But some who studied the question believe such a release would pose a great risk to Hanoi.
If they released all of them, they'd release 10,000 horror stories.
The majority of our time in the camp was forced labor, disease, starvation.
Even the hint of movement has sent a wave of hope through the Vietnamese community in the United States. Cuc Minh Thaw, an Arlington, Virginia office worker, is president of the Vietnamese Political Prisoners Association, just founded last week. Her husband is a former Army colonel, now imprisoned by Hanoi. He has admitted in letters he probably won't see her again. But Mrs. Thaw suddenly is less pessimistic.
You know, I hope, but, you know, sometimes I'm upset, I'm depressed, I'm disappointed. But now I hope a lot.
Her group will try to help 15-year-old Ta Swan Le, who last saw his imprisoned father in 1979. The father has not been told yet that his wife and two other sons died at sea as they fled Vietnam. Young Le rehearses a father-son reunion.
I say, Dad, I miss you a lot. Let's say if he's here right now, I say, right now in our family, only two of us, so we'll try and make the best out of life.
Dennis Trout, ABC News, Washington.
In just a moment, the search for defective computer chips in America's defense systems.
Okay. The FVPPA was founded by women whose families were in re-education camps, and they did it all on a volunteer basis. And I cannot talk enough about the FVPPA. I could talk for a whole day on it, and especially its president and founder, Cuc Minh Thaw, who you saw in that video. Cuc Minh Thaw is an amazing person. She grew up during the French Indochina War and World War II, and she would help the orphans with her mother. Her mother died shortly after this picture, and her youngest brother did too. Her three older brothers ended up in re-education camps, and her father was killed during the war, and so was her stepmother. And also, when she was pregnant, her love of her life, her first husband, who was an incredibly courageous captain who inspired fierce loyalty and bravery in his men. In fact, they're still her biggest supporters because they're still loyal to him. And it was because of her promises to him when he died to look after the other soldiers and also to want to free her second husband that she created the FVPPA and fought so hard and gave so much of her life to the FVPPA. And whenever you hear about her, you hear that, you know, she was a strong woman, she's very soft-spoken, very kind, and you always hear this hushed, reverent voice about the most beautiful girl, and she was, and still is. And she's an incredible person. let me do this. Where is... I'm sorry. It's not from current... Okay, I'm going to go real fast to get to where I was. Forgive me. Okay, we have patrons from all over. We've had people physically come to our archive from Switzerland and Vietnam and California to research this collection. And from online, I've gotten inquiries from Australia, Macau, Vietnam, all over. It's attracted a lot of attention. The two most biggest patron bases, of course, are... the Vietnamese community, not only in the United States, but in Vietnam and overseas Vietnamese, looking for family and looking for friends and their orderly departure program. And then my second biggest one are American Vietnam veterans looking to what happened to their Vietnamese counterparts. And what was really neat is less than a year after the collection was opened, it helped win a political asylum case for this Vietnamese gentleman, Captain Zhang, to come to the U.S. And this is the lawyer that helped him because it proved the horrible conditions of the re-education camps. And then it helped reunite friends who had been separated after 42 years because they found the sponsor. He resettled in Canada, but his friend resettled here in the States. And he used our files to find his friend. And I write about it, everything related to this project, in our news and updates. The barriers, it's a new project. It's only 2008. I'm an outsider. I'm not Vietnamese American. I'm this little blonde girl. Location, we're not located in Orange County with the biggest Vietnamese American community, or in Dallas and Houston, which have the second and third. We're located in Lubbock, Texas. So I try to do everything as much as I can online. Time. It takes time to create a new project. It takes time to earn trust with the Vietnamese American community. And also the fact that I'm the Vietnamese American Heritage Archivist, but we are short-staffed, and so I don't spend all my time on this project. I don't spend all, I'd like to do 100%, but that's just not possible. And funding, we all have that problem. Funding in space. The biggest barrier that I get when I try to get Vietnamese to participate in our VAHP is everyone went through it. And my story's not special. And I have to tell them your story is of value, and it's a story of courage and overcoming great adversity, and perseverance. And they're also afraid of reprisal, because especially with my collection, when they're re-education camp prisoners, they were often extorted in the past about, okay, you were in the re-education camps from Vietnamese who would come to the U.S. They'd find them and say, okay, well, if you don't give us money, we'll hurt your family more, because they not only punish them, they punish their whole entire family. Their kids were denied education, which is why so many of them came here, because their kids didn't have a future either. The misunderstanding of our scholarships. We have scholarships that take students to Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, and also that give money to the poorest students. And I always have to reiterate that we're not supporting the Socialist Republic of Vietnam government. We're supporting the people. And what we're doing is we're trying to do a reconciliation and encourage a cultural understanding and history in Texas Tech students. We're not supporting the government. And so there's always that confusion about our scholarships. Overcoming the barriers. How do we do it? Raising awareness of the program through online as much as I can. Cultural understanding, it always breaks the ice when I tell them my favorite Vietnamese fairy tale, and then they tell me theirs, or I show that I have a sense of their history, the Chinese influence, the French influence, what they went through in the re-education camps, because I've taken the time to learn and to care about their culture. Building rapport and trust with the Vietnamese Americans, by doing that opening ceremony for the FVPPA and getting letters of congratulations and support from the UN, from the International Red Cross, from President Clinton, from President Bush, Senator Kerry, Senator Dole, and Senator McCain, I showed them this collection, that I saw its importance. And I did this, and I contacted the VIPs who played a part in helping their immigration and then held an opening for it. So that was the first step. And then when they found out that it helped win a political asylum case and reunite friends, they loved it. And then the next thing you know, they're helping me because they're publishing it in Vietnamese American publications, Hot Blue, and and so they helped a lot. And it inspired more trust because it showed them that I cared about the documents that they entrusted with me. Online access and presence. That's the biggest thing I do right now because I don't have the funding to travel as much as I would like to. And do things on a tight budget. I collaborate with other departments on college for some cultural events, and I try to get grants. The biggest event that we do for culture is the Lunar New Year, which is the biggest Vietnamese holiday. And we have Vietnamese food. It's free to the public. And you can see these little girls on the left in the traditional Vietnamese clothing, their ao yais. And on the bottom right is our announcement online. And up at the top, just to show you a contrast, is another Vietnamese association's invitation to Tet. And also the fact is that we have the Vietnamese Student Association talk about the Vietnamese culture, so that when they come and eat, they learn about the culture. The second biggest holiday is the Mid-Autumn Moon Festival. And so I've done preschool programs. I've had them come to the archive. And they love the lanterns, and they love the children's parade, and they love the fairy tales because that's two of the big things. And, like, these are some posters that I created for the kids to look at that have different aspects about the Mid-Autumn Moon Festival. And, you know, the masks, the food, the dances, the lanterns. And then the kids make little masks, and they have fun, and they listen to the fairy tales. And then I've started an Asian Pacific American Heritage Month online exhibit. And that is May, okay? And they learn about the history of APHM. And they learn, there's links to maps about who Asian Pacific Americans are. And then they can learn about the Vietnamese collections and stuff that we have. And then what's really cool is I've also given synopsis of all our oral histories that we've done that relate to Vietnamese Americans. And, like, this is Cuc Minh Tha, and it has pictures, it talks about her collection, it talks about her life, and then at the bottom is a link to the oral history so they actually hear the oral history. And then this is another important one, but he's actually Cambodian. I collaborated on this one with our oral history one to get, is Ambassador Si Jun Siv. He's very important to the Cambodian community. And then Ambassador Nguyen used to work for us. This was before my time, so I didn't get to interview him, unfortunately. I would love to. And then another one, this is Mindy Elliott. She is the first person that I've gotten to interview who actually came to the U.S. through the FVPPA's help. And we have her father's ODP application file. And her husband actually surprised her and approached me about finding her dad's file for genealogical purposes for their grandkids. And because her father had just passed away, and he wanted it as a gift, and it just meant a lot to her. And I've gotten a lot of really poignant, moving letters from people who have found their family's application files. And then this is also before my time. I didn't get to do it. Is Ambassador Diem with Dr. Reckner on the right. The exhibit also talks about Vietnamese Refugee Day and has links to some famous Vietnamese Americans so they can look them up. And then it talks about the events that we have. I've started the Asian Pacific American Heritage Month Film Festival. And you can see the poster, and it has the films. And then we created a webpage where they can find out the show times. And then here they can find out a synopsis. And this movie is about Camp Pendleton, like you mentioned. And it says running times has a link to reviews and stuff like that, and they can watch the movie trailer to see if they really want to come see that movie. And then, I've gotten to attend two events. The FVPPA's Political Prisoners Day, which was in Dallas. It was the first time Vietnamese political prisoners from all over the world gathered together. There was over 10,000 Vietnamese there in the evening session for the culture show, because the morning was the more professional stuff. And all the time I got these looks like, what's this little white girl doing here? And she's too young to remember Vietnam. What is she doing? But then when Cuc Minh Tha called me on stage and gave me a hug, then it just broke the ice with everyone, because if Cuc Minh Tha says I'm okay, then I'm okay. And then it made me cry because I got introduced to this whole line of women whose all of their husbands had died in the re-education camps. And one by one they're telling me their story and they're not letting go of my hand. And I just wanted to cry. At that event, I got to meet Texas Representative Congressman Hubert Vo, who's a Vietnamese American. And on the right, you will see Nancy Bui, who is the president of the Vietnamese American Heritage Foundation, who gave us this collection. And there's just some other pictures. And the other event that I got to go to was the Vietnamese American Heritage Foundation's painting a picture at the Bob Bullitt Museum in Austin. And on the right is the flyer for it, the invitation. And they had a culture show, which you can see at the top left. And at the bottom right, they had 500 people come, and they could look at things and read the exhibit, which had a lot of oral histories with Vietnamese Americans. And a lot of former re-education camp prisoners were there, and they did crafts and food. And one guy made all these beautiful sculptures out of Play-Doh. And then I got to meet other members of the VHF, and then Linda Hopeche, whose students conducted the interviews. And then the other big way I keep in touch is newsletter. Like, I just recently collaborated with some coworkers of mine to get a grant from NHPRC for about $145,000 to digitize the FVPPA, and we were awarded it. And that was another big step with the Vietnamese American community, because as soon as we got it, that's what they wanted, because we weren't in the biggest communities. They wanted access to it. And it's almost 160 linear feet, and so to process it was a big deal, and to get it digitized, and hopefully within the next 2 years, our deadline is 3 years, but it looks like we're actually ahead of schedule right now, but let's hope it stays that way. But the goal is for 2 more years, and then it'll be all online. And then I have a news and update. It's like our blog, and so anything related to this collection, anything that's happening with the VAHP, I post about it. Like, this is showing them the students. It's highlighting the 5 students I have working for me that are scanning the collection right now. And then we also have a guest lecture series, which is funded by the Helen Jones Foundation. And the thing is it, we have a lot of speakers, but one of the coolest ones is that my boss got Kim Fook to come. She's the little girl that was 7 years old that was naked being burned by napalm. And so she came and spoke, and it was an incredible talk. And this is my info, you know, our work phone, our website, and my email and our address. And, you know, please come get a brochure if you're interested. And thank you for coming to this session. I hope it's helped you, give you some ideas on our different approaches for refugees, because as archivists, we are the preservers and keepers of our society's history and knowledge and culture. And the refugees are a voice that need to be heard. They're our newest citizens, and they're unique. And especially in a democratic society, you need all perspectives. And so thank you. And if you have a question, please say so, and I'll repeat it. And we have about we have 8 minutes. I'm so sorry. But we have 8 minutes for questions, if anyone would like to ask anything. Yes. Sure. You want to go first, Christine?
Repeat the question.
Okay. She's asking how we kind of balance what we're doing with our outreach project and how we, with our obligations, and especially if this, since it isn't full time, how we're managed to accomplish and overcome these hurdles is basically what I hear you saying, right?
That's true.
Well, thank you for your kind words and for your question. Oh, my gosh. For me, sometimes I feel that way, too. For me, it's because I have a passion for it, and I love it, and so I refuse to let it die. I just am determined, and I try my best to, I just try really best to juggle things and to do time management. But it gets harder and harder, especially as we've gotten more and more short-staffed. And the fact that it's such a new project, it's been, and we're not in a prime location, it's been very hard. So if it wasn't for people like Cookman Ta or Nancy Bowie, or that I got lucky and got this collection, and then I told my boss, hey, I think this is special, let's hold the opening ceremony because I think it's special, and he let me run with it, then none of this would happen. And then what the researchers themselves are doing and what the Vietnamese community has done themselves with, because I've kept in touch with them and they've been so excited about what it's done, they've published stuff themselves. And so, but it's been a slow because, like I said, I'm the little blonde white girl that was only 4 months old when Vietnam fell. So, how about you? So I hope that helped. I just am determined.
There are lots of things that we want to do that we're not doing, that we're not able to do. So there's, you know, that's like our private thing. And now I've put it in the record, so what am I going to do? I think what we've, at UC Irvine, we were in a situation a lot of colleges and universities and libraries are in, which is reduced funding, a lot of unfilled positions, and so we're focusing on our core mission now. So a lot of things that we would like to do and we feel are important to do are taking a little bit of a backseat to instruction, collection building, and reference. And so the outreach part is important, but we can't sacrifice our reference, instruction, and collection building to do that. So it becomes, you know, this sort of losing sleep at night over this. I think what we're trying to do, and this is partly represented by the partnership with the UCI School of Humanities and Asian American Studies, where Thuy's project, the Vietnamese American Oral History Project, is based. So this is a wonderful partnership. If somebody were to come to us, the staff of the libraries, and say, could you undertake this project, We wouldn't be able to do that. So thanks to TWE's efforts and the funding from an anonymous donor for 3 years, this project is in very, very capable hands. So in essence, it's kind of been outsourced. And so for us to build partnerships with other places on other units on campus, parts of the community, to have a Southeast Asian Archive Advisory Board to be in the community for us. When Anne Frank retired in 2007, she had been able to spend a lot of time out in the community and going to events and not only bringing back materials for the collection, but also promoting the archive as a place and as a collection and as an important part of the memory building for the community. Since I have other responsibilities and maybe at most work on the archive a quarter of my time, I'm not able to go out into the community evenings and weekends and that sort of thing the way she was able to. So we're spreading that work around to other people. And otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do it at all.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, I think from our perspective, I mean, we're currently in the process of, in a sort of transition process at the moment. We're currently lucky enough to have a slight background. Our university campus is currently split across two separate sites. So, and we're sort of lucky enough at the moment to be sort of part of the way through construction of a brand new sort of purpose-built library, which will be hopefully coming on stream early next year. The outcome of that is it could well be possible that the archive is subsequently split across these two sites, which, given the current staffing situation, may well mean that will be split across the two sites, which will have sort of obvious knock-on effects to the sort of level of service we'll be able to offer for sort of each of our sort of archival collections. So we're currently in a period of transition at the moment. So I think we have to wait to see how that pans out over the next sort of 6 to 9 months to see where we go from there in the future.
Basically, she's talking about whether we should be helping educate about what archives are, and then the word choices that we use, because it, like Twee said about storage versus archive, and we use words like heritage and stuff like that, and that's what we're doing too at the Vietnam Center and Archive, and that's why my physician is a Vietnamese American heritage archivist. And what I like about the word heritage is it not only encompasses the storage aspect of their documents, but it talks about it's their culture, it's their future, it encompasses all. It's their history, it's their immigration experience. And so it kind of is jam-packed into one word. But I think that there is a need to do some education about what archives are, because I think that's an element of trust that we need to build so that they can understand what we're doing and how we're trying to help them, and that we're not just going to shove it somewhere and let it get moldy and that kind of thing.
I would agree with everything Anna's saying, because I don't think that when you choose alternative terms that you're actually dumbing down the significance of the archive, but I think that one needs to precede the other. So in terms of knowing your audience, for instance, I interview folks who were captains, generals, and Arvin, and people who were farmers and peasants and homemakers and who didn't have a formal education. So they really run the spectrum, and so you really have to know who you're talking to and pick the right terminology where you can relate to them first. And I think the education about the archive can be, or its significance and what it does, can be embedded in that thereafter. And you have to also accept that some of these folks just won't care. what the archive can do or its potential or care to learn more about that, because that's just not a part of their present reality. I just interviewed a woman who was a seamstress for 30 years, still is. You know, this was her first job in America, and she continues to work in a sweatshop in LA. And so does she have time to understand what the archive is? Is this going to affect or transform anything in her life? But no, what we're doing is showing her that she can foster a better relationship with her son, who drove her down to Orange County to meet me after 3 failed attempts to interview her. So, you know, it can be utilitarian in that sense, but I think that the product, what comes out of it, will speak for itself. You know, and her son will use this. He's also the director at CAM LA, or Chinese American Museum in LA, so hopefully he will exhibit it as well. So, you know, I'm always thinking about the different audiences that I'm speaking to and how we can make this relevant to their lives. But the education part is always there for me as well.
Right. And it's like the Vietnamese American Heritage Foundation, they went to Cuc Minh Tha, and she has all the records in her house. And so she had, over 160 linear feet. That's only half of it, what we have. And she's going to give us the other half, hopefully someday soon, is what we were talking to her about, the rest of it, in her house. And so the VHF is like, we need to preserve these, they're important records. And then because of Dr. Reckner's reputation with the Vietnamese American community and the trust that they have for him, they gave him to us. But we always have to, it's just like any patron you talk to as an archivist, is like what we can do for you, how we will take care of these records and show you that, you know, we're worthy of the trust you're giving us with these documents by handing them over to us. And it's the same kind of thing. And with me, the keeping in touch about what it's been doing, how it's been used, has been phenomenal in that trust building. And then also the fact that they weren't stored properly when they moved to Austin, so some of them got damaged and moldy. And so we talked about, look at all the money that we're spending to make sure climate controlled, and then, you know, these documents won't get hurt anymore. We'll do what we can to preserve them and fix the ones that have light mold damage and stuff like that. And, you know, cost effectively, can you guys preserve your heritage as well as we can? You know, that's just a little part of it, which comes down to money, but it's because we're a university. But you have those whole things with the trust and talk when any patron that you talk to about why they should give you, why should they trust you with your stuff, with their stuff. Make sense?
Okay. Just the last thing that I think a lot of folks who we court to receive their records don't understand that they're not losing all of the control. If there are materials that they want us to restrict for X number of years or X number of decades, they can do that. And so if there are family secrets that they don't want researchers to reveal, or other family members, people they know to come use the materials, they can just put, a restricted access on that. And so other researchers in the future will have access, and it won't just sort of be discarded or shredded or, tossed out when the family, says goodbye to their last family member. So that kind of assurance maybe helps some of them realize that, I can give this up.
Yes?
Yeah, they're giving up their story. So the question is, if these families... Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. Because, I think everything that Anna had said about the folks saying, first of all, everyone has this experience, so why is mine unique? And then, I don't really have anything special to share. The kind of work that I have to do before an interview is actually the most important work in getting them to the table. And then after that, once they start to see, especially the product, and I do a lot of showing rather than telling people, I do a lot of showing, and that really helps them to solidify in their minds, this is, these are folks who are going to take care of my story. And so I'm having people bringing in things like their identification cards from refugee camps, whatever they have in their collection, and some of it. One gentleman was such a historian in his own right. He kept this brochure that the USS Peleliu, this boat that saved their refugee boat, gave them all brochures when they came on board, right? And this is us, and this is who we are and what we do. And he saved that. And so he's everything that he can dig up, he's bringing to me. So, and there are folks like that. And then, of course, there are folks who just, you know, they don't have anything. And then others who think, well, this is too precious or too personal for me to share at this moment, but we can digitize them. So I'm getting a lot of digital copy rather than the originals as well through the Oral History Project.
Any other questions? Yeah, thank you so much for coming, and thank you for attending the session and for your thoughtful questions. I appreciate it. And I hope you guys enjoy the rest of the conference today. And travel safe if you're leaving today. Thank you.